project that this is a result of. Lou Rowinsky from the University Museum and myself from the University Archives had long been thinking of kind of a history of the Richardson, or thinking of the Richardson in terms of what its import is to Alaska. And we were able to obtain funding for a kind of a comparative photographic study and interpretation of Richardson Highway, which Rocky Roses graciously agreed to help interpret. What we attempted to do was to go back through the files that we had in the University Archives, and several thousand photographs of the Richardson Highway from the early 1900s on. And one of the things we saw that was really lacking was any comparative photographs from recent times on the length of the highway. So one of the aspects of the project was to photograph the highway at this point in time, so that we would have a large number of photographs taken in 75. Originally we tried to take it 74, but taken in 75. So that people would have a base to compare what it is right now with what it was 10, 15, or 50 years ago. And so we've endeavored to use this display technique where there are some current photographs and some, most of them are quite old. But we have gotten about somewhere between 1,000 and 1,500 current photographs between Fairbanks and Valdez, and these we're using kind of as a base study so that, say, 10 or 15 or another 50 years, somebody else can look at the highway and see what it was in 75 and see what it was in the early 1900s. We've endeavored to do this for the length of the highway, particularly at this point, because we think that the highway is changing very, very rapidly at this point between the pipeline and the much heavier traffic on it. The agency that funded this, and we kind of have to put in a pitch for them, is the Alaska Humanities Forum. And their theme is really land bridge to community. We're trying to interpret the history of the highway, and then I think it's up to you folks to see in a better way how the highway really has contributed to community in Alaska. It's been really the first long highway that has connected the major centers in Alaska. It's been heavily used. It's been a real focal point, I think, in Alaska's history. So this is our thing, is that it's a historic highway. It's been used for over 60, 70 years now. And it has not only tied the communities together, but also tied essentially the greater part of Alaska together. And without further ado, I'd like to introduce Rocky Roads, a transportation specialist from the University of Alaska and also former commanding officer of the Arctic Test Center down at Fort Greely. Rocky.
Thank you, Paul. Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to spend the next 20 or 30 minutes with a rather brief discussion as to the origin and development of the Richardson Highway as we know it today. I'm sure most of you are familiar with the map of Alaska, but historically, even from Aboriginal times, the access to the interior of Alaska has been primarily the Yukon River. And during the early days, prior to the American occupation, American possession of Alaska, the Russians occupied the southern coast and entered just short distances up the Yukon and Kuskokwim rivers. The Canadians, British actually, in pursuit of furs, which was the primary objective also of the Russians, came in from the Canadian side down the Porcupine River and up the Yukon River from its head. During the years immediately preceding the purchase of Alaska, there was a major effort to construct a telegraph line from the United States to Europe through Siberia. And as a result of this effort, the Western Union Company launched a survey of this telegraph line coming up from what is now Southeast Alaska, up to the headwaters of the Yukon River, down the Yukon, and then they were going to go across the Bering Strait into Siberia. And Robert Kennicott and William Dahl were two primary individuals who contributed to the knowledge of the interior of Alaska during that survey. After the purchase, there was really no great deal of interest in the interior of Alaska. The United States, of course, took over Alaska at the capital of Sitka, and the primary interest was continuation of furs and fish, which had been primary activity of the Russians. Gold had been discovered by the Russians, but it was not pursued to any great degree. The real magnet to the interior of Alaska was gold. This was a follow-on from the California, Colorado gold rushes. The Cassiar area in British Columbia was struck in 1871 as a result of the activity in Cassiar. There were a lot of American entrances through Southeast Alaska, and in 1880, Juno and Harris discovered the lode source of gold at the present site of Juno, and that was the beginning of the Treadwell mine. A lot of gold seekers continued in following the mountain area where gold is traditionally found, on up through Canada into the Yukon Valley in the 1880s. But the only real overland access into the Yukon was through Canada. Otherwise, one had to go all the way around the Alaskan Peninsula, up here to the head of the Yukon River, and by boat up the Yukon. Not only is this a long trip, it's almost 1,000 miles to the Alaskan border from St. Michael, but the river is only open 3 months out of the year. So in the 80s, there was a great deal of interest and effort on the part of the United States government to provide overland access through United States territory without having to go through Canadian territory. And in 1884, Lieutenant Allen of the United States Army, Captain Abercrombie of the United States Army, was directed by the War Department to explore the Copper River Valley and any other possible accesses into the interior of Alaska. In 1885, Lieutenant Allen continued. Abercrombie did not make it up the Copper River, but Allen did, and he was able to traverse this route up to the Tanana River over what is now the Mentassa Pass. At the same time, Lieutenant Glenn entered Cook Inlet and was able to traverse overland up to the Copper River over what is now the Glenn Highway. In 1896, in the early 1890s, gold was discovered up here in Birch Creek on the Yukon, and the major activity in American territory was in the upper part of the Yukon River, centering around Circle. To get to Circle from the Canadian route, one had to cross the border, and for this reason, the Army established garrisons at Eagle. They also established a garrison here at Tanana, which was Fort Gibbon. The headquarters was at St. Michael because that was still the primary American entrance into Alaska. And in 1896, gold was discovered at Klondike. And this was the real spark plug that triggered the present day growth of Alaska and northwestern Canada, too, for that matter. The famous Chilkoot Trail from Skagway was the primary route to the Klondike goldfields, although there were many other routes used up the Stikine River, overland, down the Porcupine, and up the Yukon, which was a heck of a long route. Of course, miners came in the Yukon from the mouth. And in the winter of 1897, rumor had it that there was a trail from Port Valdez in Prince William Sound that would permit an easier access and a shorter access to Dawson than any of the existing routes. That winter, And in the spring of 98, over 2,000 gold seekers attempted to cross the Valdez Glacier, come up this route to the Copper River Valley, and thence in this direction up to the gold fields. A good many of them perished. Most of them didn't make it. But that action was the beginning of the present city and port of Valdez. It did become recognized as a useful port. It was ice-free year-round, and it was an easier access inland, actually, than the Copper River. In 1898, Captain Abercrombie was directed by the War Department to locate and mark and establish a military trail from Valdez to Eagle. This was started in 1899. The surveys were completed by 1904. But in the interim, another event that was significant to interior of Alaska, that was Felix Pedro's discovery of gold here in Pedro Creek. And at the same time, Captain Barnett grounded his riverboat. He was heading, actually, up here to the crossing of the Tanana of this Valdez Eagle Trail. But he never got there because of low water. And by a very chance meeting, Pedro and Barnett got together. Pedro had found the gold. Barnett had the supplies. These two things were the beginning of Fairbanks. There was no direct access between the coast and Fairbanks at that time. But the miners started operating, most of them coming up the Yukon and up the Tanana River to Fairbanks area, operating out of here. And the rivers, Salter Creek, Shaw Creek, Tenderfoot Creek, these creeks up the Tanana Valley were explored, as was all the country between the Fairbanks area, Circle, and Eagle. In 1904, a district judge in Fairbanks died of a heart attack, and an individual named of Klondike Mike Mahoney volunteered to take him by dog sled from Fairbanks down to Valdez. Now, Abercrombie had reconnoitered the route up through Keystone Canyon and Thompson Pass on up to Copper Center. And from Copper Center, the trail took off to Eagle. So from Copper Center south was known, from Fairbanks down to near the Delta River was known, but the stretch in between, which goes over Isabel Pass, had never been traversed. So Mike Mahoney struck out on his own, and he had quite a struggle, but he finally arrived at Copper Center, and then, of course, from there on, it was easy down to Valdez. And in 1905, the interest of the United States government had increased to the point where it was recognized that an authorized and organized system of transportation in Alaska had to be initiated. And the Army had been doing most of the pioneering work, which is pretty traditional in the western part of the United States, that the Army did a lot of the initial exploring and trail pioneering, and it was the same thing in Alaska. The Alaska Road Commission was established in 1905 under the War Department, and Captain W.P. Richardson was the first commissioner. And he designated as the first priority of the Road Commission developing this trail from Valdez to Fairbanks to provide inland access from a year-round tidewater port. And that was the beginning of the Richardson Highway as we know it today. Now, as people who have been up here know, and most everyone else has read about, the problems of getting around in muskeg country and frozen ground and deep snow is difficult. Most of the time in northern countries, it's actually easier to travel in the winter than it is in the summer, because at least the muskeg and the waterways are frozen, and you can go over them. All you have to do is worry about snow. And sleds are a pretty good means of getting across snow. The dog sled has been established in the northern countries for many, many years. And with reasonable trail preparation, horse-drawn sleds can be used to carry heavier cargo than is possible with a dog sled. So the first improvement of this trail, as it was pioneered out by Mike Mahoney, was to prepare it for winter travel. Of course, the trail between the present Delta Junction area and Copper Center, there was no trail, and that was constructed by the Road Commission, and the other portions of the trail were used, were improved. The standards for a winter trail were that it was to be 6 foot wide, the right-of-way or the roadway was to be 6 foot wide, but because it was only used in the wintertime and drainage was not a problem, the surface did not have to be crowned and ditched. This was done for the first 3 years of the trail. It provided access for winter mail for both passenger and freight travel by horse-drawn sled, and also provided a source of fresh meat for Alaska by permitting cattle to be trailed from Valdez to Fairbanks. The next activity of the commission was to prepare an all-weather road or a wagon road. A wagon road had to be at least 8 foot wide. It had to be crowned and ditched for drainage in the summertime. And of course, the biggest problem was crossing muskeg swamps and open bodies of water. Now, there were a number of techniques developed back in those early years that are pretty standard practice in road building today. For instance, we have been reading in the papers recently about the construction of roads, primarily the Alaska Pipeline Road, and the use of insulation on the surface of the ground and building up a road surface on top of that in order to prevent the permafrost from thawing. Well, that technique was used by the Alaska Road Commission back as early as 1910. And their technique was not to blade off any vegetation off the ground, but to cover it with a layer of logs called corduroy, and then earth on top of that. And the whole idea was to keep the permafrost frozen during the summer so that the roadbed would be solid. A second technique, which is also used, particularly in the areas further south, was to actually blade the surface off, expose the frozen ground to the sunlight, and then just let nature take its course for a period of several years. Eventually, the permafrost was melted, the road was consolidated and sagged all it was going to sag. Then it was a matter of filling in the holes, blading off the surface, crowning and grading, and you had a road that was reasonably usable. Of course, you had to keep doing this. If the permafrost was not completely melted, then you had to do it every year. And that's nothing new. We're doing that every year up here today. Some of the roads not very far from here, as a matter of fact. There was copper discovered by the early prospectors and noted and publicly recorded by the Army explorations, in particular Lieutenant Allen coming up in the Mentasta Pass area, had noted in his reports extensive deposits of copper. And Abercrombie, who was very active in the area, in his report of 1899 noted that a railroad could be built from Valdez across Marshall Pass coming up the Copper River and this trail, which he said that the tremendous amounts of copper up there would make a railroad feasible. In the early part of the century, the Guggenheim Foundation, a very wealthy business organization, bought the mining properties, bought the Alaska Steamship Company, built a railroad, strictly to get this copper out of this area. During the early surveys for the railroad, there were a number of railroad companies very hastily formed to get in on the action. And there was quite a rivalry between a railroad going up the Copper River and a railroad coming out of Valdez. And if you have a chance to get down in Keystone Canyon, you can see at least one example of part of the early effort to build a railroad up the Keystone Canyon Marshall Pass area. There's still a tunnel shaft, which was to be the start of a tunnel to reduce the grade coming out of Keystone Canyon, getting over to Marshall Pass. Of course, this would have made the work of the Alaska Road Commission considerably easier because the railroad grade has to be pretty well constructed. Would have saved them a lot of effort and actually improved the access from Valdez to the interior. As it turned out, the Copper River route won out, and Mike Haney, who had been very active in building the Yukon to White Pass Railroad, shown here, at the turn of the century, completed by the turn of the century, was the primary engineer in locating and constructing the Copper River Railroad, which went over here to Kennecott, the Guggenheim mines. But the Valdez Road remained a road. It was rapidly upgraded to wagon standards so that a wagon could go over the road. And the first wagon actually made the entire trip between Fairbanks and Valdez in 1910. And about this time, the gasoline engine and the vehicle came into the picture. And Bobby Sheldon drove a Model T Ford down the trail, completing it in 1913. And there are several newspaper clippings on the back row there describing Bobby Sheldon's exploit. And from that time on, vehicle travel became more and more prominent, and the necessity to go from a wagon road to something that would support higher speed and heavier traffic was required. This required better surfacing, and gravel was used, and the road was finally graveled all the way. World War II caused a significant increase in activity in interior Alaska. The Army constructed the Alaska Highway, which came up and joined the Richardson Highway at what is now Delta Junction. At that time it was called Buffalo Center. And also the Glen Highway was built from Palmer, which was already joined by highway from Anchorage, from Palmer on up to the present town of Glen Allen, which joined the Copper River at that point, joined the Richardson Highway along the Copper River. Later, this road was extended on up to Tope, so that you had a cross roads at the Copper Center area. And significantly, that was one of the earlier crossroads back in the early days, when it was still trade. The years following World War II saw a continued improvement and upgrading of the highway. It was paved in 1951. The use of the highway for recreation and tourism continued to increase. There was some increase during the construction, military construction in the late 50s and early 60s of the Dew Line. The port of Valdez, however, had lost a good deal of its significance when the Alaska Railroad was built, constructed up Fairbanks. This permitted direct unloading from ship to rail and then travel up the Fairbanks, and the port of Valdez somewhat declined. However, the next step, and the one that we're in right now, in the history of the Richardson Highway, was the discovery of oil at Prudhoe Bay and the subsequent decision to construct a pipeline from Prudhoe Bay to Valdez. Then from the portion of the highway to somewhat to the south of Fairbanks, the pipeline will parallel the highway down to the port of Valdez. A major facility is being constructed in Valdez, and I know that that we will see the continued use and significance of this famous old trail, Valdez-Fairbanks Trail, for many, many years to come, and the re-emergence of Valdez as a major port for access to the interior of Alaska. I'll be happy to answer any questions. If you'd like to go around the room again and look at the pictures, be perfectly free.
Just a comment for the listeners who aren't familiar with Fairbanks. Bobby Sheldon, you mentioned, took the first long tour, so living here in Fairbanks. Is 19, I think?
Is that right? For goodness sake. As another matter of interest of Bobby Sheldon, he built the first powered vehicle in Alaska. It was made out of a marine inboard very small motor and wagon, buggy wagon parts, and that vehicle is over here in the museum at the University of Alaska. Any of you that have a chance to get to that museum can see Bobby Shillen's first vehicle.
The little red
wagon. The little red wagon. Yeah. Tom?
One of the historical markers down along the road has some part of a story about how a locomotive was called up over the mountain. I forget the story. Do you know anything about that?
Couldn't hear what you were saying, Tom.
A story about how a locomotive was called up for the Copper River Railway. It was loaded on wagons or something. Do you know anything about that story?
Well, I'm not sure that I know that particular one, but both locomotives and boats were hauled overland by wagon and reassembled at the site. Paul, do you know anything about that particular?
Yeah, I remember hearing the story.
Yeah,
and over Marshall Pass and down.
I think there's a marker of some kind that tells part of that story up in Marshall Pass somewhere up there.
Yeah, that's right. Refresh my memory. The railroad was being constructed. One of the hardest parts, of course, was getting up into the Copper River. But in order to make faster time, they also started constructing up in this area. And in order to get a locomotive up there, they couldn't get it up the Copper River because the Copper River is not navigable. And there's no real trail there. They were building as they went along. So they did take it up by wagon over Marshall Pass. Dropped into the Copper River and there put it on the tracks.
Why did they put the capital of Alaska turned on in there where there isn't even a road?
Why is that? Why is the capital down here?
Yeah, why did they put it down there and then they put it over there where there was a road?
Well, that's what's going on now, putting it next to a road. But the reason is that there was nothing up here, there was nobody up here. All the action in Alaska at the time we took over the territory was in this area. The Russians originally had their capital at Kodiak. They moved over to Sitka. When we took over Alaska, we took it over at Sitka, and the territorial government decided to establish the territorial capital at Sitka. It was later moved to Juneau. Of course, the fact that the big mine at Juneau was discovered there, that became then pretty much the center of wealth, and also the major fishing industry, which actually exceeded gold. In the early days as the economic resource base of Alaska was all centered in southeast Alaska. It wasn't until Klondike in 96 that there was any real significant interest in the interior of Alaska. If Klondike hadn't been discovered, we would all be living down here, those of us that were living in Alaska, unless we were still trying to find some gold.
The stream crossings, once the Richardson was made into road for vehicles. Could you comment on some of those stream crossings and how they managed to get across the major rivers? I guess there wouldn't be too many.
There were several ferries. The last ferry in operation was the one across the Tanana, and it operated up into the 30s until a permanent bridge was finally put in. And when the permanent bridge was put in about 1940 or 41, at the time of the military buildup, in order to provide faster access across the river than the ferry. The earlier bridges there were some footbridges built by the individuals that were using the trail, and people that established roadhouses sometimes would build a footbridge, make it a little easier for passengers to get to their roadhouse. The horses had to wade for it. The Road Commission started building bridges over all the streams, beginning in 1906 with the bridge over the Tasnina River down here in the Copper River Basin. These were wooden bridges, traditionally with breakup conditions in Alaska. The wooden bridges almost always went out, and it was just a custom to build a wooden bridge and then rebuild it every spring. But later on, when things became more permanent, particularly during war and after the war, these temporary bridges were all replaced with steel bridges with foundations high enough so that the spring ice would not take out the foundations of the bridge. The Alaska Highway was completed in a period of about 9 months in 1942 from Dawson Creek to to down the junction with all wooden bridges. And as long as it was a military road, why, that was a recognized fact of life. They just rebuilt the bridges. Once the war was over, it was established as a civilian highway for public use. The bridges then were all replaced with permanent steel bridges. Greg?
Rocky, for the benefit of our visitors and new people to the area, you might want to mention something a little bit more about the roadhouses, which is kind of a unique thing to Alaska that's very closely related to the roads that you're talking about.
Well, I really hadn't planned to, because a significant part of our display here is about the roadhouses. But I will mention that these were like the old post houses established back in ancient history days, in the times of the Romans and the Egyptians and the Genghis Khan's Mongolians and Alexander the Great, and the missionaries out in California. These way stations were established at an average day's travel. Well, with foot travel, this could be 10 miles. With dog sled or horse travel, it could be anywhere from 20 to 50. But the average day's travel was somewhere between 10 and 20 miles overall average conditions. So therefore, along the Fairbanks to Richard to Valdez stretch, roadhouses were established every 12 to 20 miles apart. No roadhouse was any farther apart than 20 miles. And we have pictures over here of a number of those roadhouses, and
they're not marked on this map. You do have a map,
Paul? We don't have that one with us, because it's
We are in the process of preparing another map, which will identify the location of all these roadhouses. But there's pictures of them over here, and they are a very essential element of the highway, as you mentioned, Greg.
Yeah, I could explain, maybe it would be a good time to explain the two displays. The one that's standing up is just a picture or kind of reconstruction of the history of the highway in terms of the man chiefly responsible for whom is Sam Richardson over there. Just the next panel shows a number of different kinds of ways of getting up the trail. You know, two guys sledding, pulling a sled with packs or with harnesses. Footpath, a bicycle, we run a lot of bicycles. In fact, there's a bicycle in the first one showing them winding up constant path along the sled. And then some of the other ways shows a steamboat coming up to the place called Rico Wallens or up to the Panama crossing. And in the back there are some showing the old trails and used to the old trails and the Army telegraph crews that really did yeoman's work. And that's where we got the picture of the old grizzly. A picture taken about 1911 by Corporal McFarland, who was responsible for developing the telegraph from Fairbanks down to Mount Donnelly. And it shows this is the old winter cutoff. It goes from Donnelly over to Washburn by Birch Lake. This was in use, I think, about 1921 when the highway was serviceable during the winter. And the trail cut off approximately 13 miles. The stop was here was Solomon's Roadhouse. We attempted to put some other related material. This is, shows horses crossing the Delta River. This point here. Next one is just the picture of Worthington Glacier showing two people visiting, which was a common occurrence in the early days, but Granville County is really rare in the South and Missouri. Clipping showing the Sheldon Strip, and the next two trips were almost. Shortly after Charlotte, one was by Manning Groves, who drove the highway from Fairbanks down to Chitna. And then just about two or three days after Charlotte, the ARC drove a truck out from Valdez to Chitna and back up to Fairbanks and back down. Which people were all marveling how great the highway was going under this week or 10 days. People blazed down there at $7 an hour. Just show some of the ways of preparing the roadbed and some of the things they were involved with, burning off some of the cover. Another one showing the stump, obviously not a rare occurrence. Again, the map showing the various places on the highway and showing a wagon train being drawn by a kind of small cat here. This is a ARC camp over the top of Keystone Canyon. And this shows some of the bridge construction. This, I think this Sheep Creek Bridge is still up down near Valdez. This is a very early picture that will show some of the different types of pier construction or preparation of side banks. Showing some of this, these pictures here were taken by one of the road engineers. The road engineers who were active in the 30s, so it shows some of the different kinds of equipment they used for blading it off or tearing it up. This shows some of the earlier horse-drawn blades. You can see the blade down here and some of the early construction camps. And this is a current view of the highway taken at 68 miles, showing the old trail, which is just cut into the ridge up here, the current highway here, and we're taking the picture from the new alignment, which is taken, which is just on the bluff above the old one. So there's really three different parts of the trail there. This may be familiar with, well, this is probably not familiar with to too many people. This is the old Sourdough Roadhouse. This is the back view of Sourdough, which is allegedly a trapper's cabin, supposedly built about 1884. These are some of the current views of the highway down at Hancock Crossing, which is at Reba Wallen's place. Places over here, showing the new roadbed and then the other roadbed, which has only been out of use about 5 years. Shows the crossing just south of Donnelly Dome, where the pipeline comes on the west side of the road where the old road was, and then crosses the new highway and then goes up the bench here just to the east of the highway. This is an interior view of one of the last of the roadhouses. Still standing three walls place down here, kind of crossing. These are just some current views. You know, when we're talking about the roadhouses, they always had three or four elements, you know, sleeping quarters, food, some kind of facilities for whatever transportation you were or are using, you know, car, dog, team, horse, whatever. And sometimes liquor. And the ones that are still existing now usually have those four elements.
You got the priority wrong there.
You're right. I realize
that.
I don't know if any of you have read John Clark's description of his crossing or coming up the highway by bicycle. I think it was 1907. But he talks about some of the roadhouses, and one, I can't remember if it was Beaver Dam or was up in the mountains. And anyway, he discussed getting in there, and the place was relatively small, probably no bigger than this half of the dome. People were absolutely jammed in. And finally, everybody got to sleep about midnight. All of a sudden, all hell broke loose about 4 o'clock. The stage came up, and people started bursting in. And he said that he thought the people in the house were really cool. He said the guy that was on the floor who was being stood up on by the person who opened the door and clomped in with the big heavy boots really didn't scream too loud. And this other guy was very chivalrous when the lady came in and was standing on his chest, upper chest and face, just asking politely. So then she immediately wanted to get away from where he was lying. So she sat down on what she thought was a bench, but was really a guy kind of up on the wall, and he was a vertical or a horizontal position. And she sat on his legs, and they went. But these are some of the kinds of stories that come out of the early roadhouses. He said that was the worst place he'd ever stayed. But there were different kinds of roadhouses. And this is just showing the moving some of the pipe in Valdez. And this is Tonsina Roadhouse, which is really one of the unusual ones. Tonsina was one of the early ones on the trail. I think you've got other pictures of it. But it burned down in the 20s. And so Derringer, who was running it, brought it over it, somewhat like a locomotive type story. He brought the whole lodge over from Fort Liskum, which is on the opposite side of Valdez Island from the current town. So that was brought up in the late 20s. So then this photograph just shows the pipe crossing below Tonsina, the route of it, and then the new warning signs which have been put up by LAS Pipeline. And then this one contrasts sharply, I think, with the first photograph. The first one shows the people struggling up the highway with dog team, bicycle, in deep snow. And they're really toughing it out. And this one shows it's taken within probably half a mile to a mile, the same spot, showing
the modern highway, clear grade, solid surface, and a big tractor trailer coming back down the grade. So it's really kind of interesting to compare the two. You know, this is an all-weather, year-round maintained highway that's almost always passable.
I found the bicycles. It's the first one.
Yeah, right. Or the last one.
The last one.
I think the bicycle is reading in some of the story we've had. We've read
the
bicycles.
Time bicycles already, about what time?
That was in, the first one was in, that we know about was in 1906.
1906.
06 or 07. But there are earlier stories of people using bicycles in Alaska and many later. But the bicyclists had a hard time because they would be cuddling up and one of the slaves would be crashing down off some of them just about wipe them out. Or they would be using it on the upper part of the highway and they would cut over on that downly cut off on the river and there would be a downstream breeze and they would just swing the tail of the bicycle around and go clattering down, upside down, wrecking the bicycle. So the first guy who came over wrote the story, got as far as down, like when he wrecked not only his bicycle but himself, and he was laid out there for a few days before going out. But that's the story of the top display. The next one in are all, almost all the roadhouses. Like, this is Rika's place here. We have the interior view showing what it was like in the probably early 20s. We've endeavored to get a picture of each of the roadhouses. And I think there are only two or maybe three missing. And Rocky's was right in commenting. We've got a chart over there that lists all the roadhouses that we know of, and either by name or location. What we've been trying to do is put multiple names because sometimes it would change often. You know, somebody would say, you know, I've had it. One guy leased, I think it was Yost up here at Isabel Summit for 6 months.
Well, we had one of the Tom Keaton Roadhouse. Did you get a picture of that?
We don't have it here, but I think we do.
I have a very good one in the interior. It shows how they have the clothes hanging over the stove and the table for the heat way in the background. It's better going up to the
What we've tried to do though is get at least one picture from almost all of them. We've got mileage charts, and we've got variant names. If you spot an error, please tell us, because it's really easy to do. Some people would like run Paxson and then go up to Yost or something like that. And Paxson, I think, is an interesting one because it was first established in 1906 as a tent. They just put the tent up in the upper valley, people came in, used the tent, and then he built a second one, which is in this place where the old one is considered the old one is now. And then he built the old one and then he built the new one. So there's four or five locations there. But there are lots of different pictures for the same roadhouse because fire is still today is a great threat and caused a lot of so-called turnover of buildings. But if you've got any questions, please feel free to ask. There's only about, I think, we figured four or five roadhouses that are maybe three that are still really in operation and offering very many services. I think Copper Center is really the only one now that is offering kind of a full range of services. And I think, you know, it's largely due to being able to go 60 miles an hour on all weather road. You don't need to stop but every 3 or 4 hours instead of every 12 miles.
What are the other ones?
Well, Richardson's is still operating.
Sourdough
is operating, but they're no longer taking in guests. They're just serving food.
I have to say something to the Richardson one now. It's not the original Richardson. The original Richardson will be way down somewhere. And Joseph
Stone's
original.
It was right down at the river. Right? There were two down at Richardson. People are quarreling about
that.
And there was a place called McCloskey's right there.
And
the
food after where the Richardson is.
Tassadine McCloskey was the other one.
No, I'm not.
Well, that was up about a half a mile from So if you've got any questions, just feel free to look at them. What we try to do is show like Munson's, two view of Munson's, what the old guide said about Munson's, and then this is essentially the only thing remaining about Munson's. It's the location of the school.
Did you get the 19-mile roadhouse?
They're all labeled. And like I said, there's maybe two or three missing. We know Gillespie's is missing, which is also called our home because we're just able to find it. We're just kind of discovering the pictures, too.
She says that one was
done
by Francis Chilton's mother, 19
Mrs. Erickson, her mother, ran the old 19-mile roadhouse. I changed hands several times after that.
That's one of the difficulties.
I had notes I could tell you what.
They would be listed. Yeah, they would be listed by proprietor, so they had like Copper Center, it was called Holman's, Blix's, Barnes, and now it's called Copper Center, it's run by George Ashby. So there are a number of proprietors for each year. That probably has turned over less than 90.
Clark, could we make a copy of the picture you have of the attorney?
I can't hear you, I'm very hard of hearing.
I want a copy.
Could we make a copy of the picture we have of the attorney?
Yes, it's in the interior, and it shows the a box with the old cylinders and the cylinder type records.
And that's the thing to remember.
Well, thank you very much for your attention, ladies and gentlemen. Feel free to wander around with the people. Take advantage of the Pioneer Museum if you want to hear. Thank you, Ben.
We enjoy that. And we'll take it to the museum.
Thank you very much. Yes, you'll find it very interesting.